Autumn Shadows in August, a novel by Robert W. Norris. Read by Robert W. Norris. Copyright 2006, Robert W. Norris. Chapter 3. The next morning we had a continental breakfast at the hotel restaurant at 7 o'clock, then hit the streets about 8. The sky was clear with only a few low clouds, but the day was cool and we both wore sweaters. We crossed the Damrak to New Wendigic, turned left and strolled slowly, Cowardy's arm in mine, along the walking path with its myriad shops and businesses. The end of the street opened out to Dam Square, and we lingered for a while with Cowardy snapping pictures of the Nieuwe Kerk and the Royal Palace. We crossed the square to where Nieuwe Digic changed into Kalverstraat, and walked along the street until it ran into the Spui. We headed down Heile Gegweg and passed the floating flower market on the Singel, Cowardy taking pictures and marveling at the colorful array of flowers, then on down Leidse Strut and over 3 canal bridges until coming upon the Leidse Plain, where we spotted the Café Américain and stopped for a half hour to rest my ankles and drink an expensive pot of coffee. Another 15 minutes of walking brought us to the Van Gogh Museum. A long line of tourists was outside the museum, but it moved quickly and soon we were inside. The ground floor was jam-packed with tourists milling around the souvenir shop, information center, and restaurant. On the next floor, there was a large selection of Van Gogh's paintings arranged in chronological order. We fell in behind the crowd. The line moved slowly but steadily. Many people stood in awe before certain paintings. We came to the potato eaters. The dusky lamplight in the center of the painting gave a slight warmth to the gray space surrounding the lamp and highlighted the hard and grave faces around the table. The 5 people in the painting were coarse and ugly. A mood of coldness, the harshness of life, jumped out at me. Cowardy took my arm, gripped it tightly, and peered closely at the painting. "These people are alive," she said. "Their eyes and expressions tell me that." I nodded, and we moved on. We stopped next at a series of self-portraits. "Check this out," I said, pointing to a self-portrait with a felt hat. "This is kind of what the world looks like on acid or mescaline. Look how his brushstrokes seem to swirl and move about. All those individual colors are amazing the way they come together. He painted himself in the same colors he used in the background. You get the illusion that he's fading into some kind of ambiguous surrounding. Incredible, hallucinogenic. It makes me dizzy to look at." Cowardy moved a step back, then closer again. He was suffering. I can understand what he was feeling. She stared hard at the painting, then lowered and shook her head slowly. "It's like looking at myself after my operation." Cowardy took my hand, looked into my eyes, and said, "I can feel the painting in my heart." I squeezed her hand, but said nothing. We started moving again and became immersed in our own musings. I moved ahead of Cowardy as she began to spend more time in front of each painting. I moved quickly through a section of landscapes until coming to 3 paintings of skulls. Skull with burning cigarette disturbed me. Its sickly greenish-yellow tones and black background reminded me of my own failures, losses, and mortality. It was another omen that resonated inside my own skull. I wondered if Malcolm Lowry had ever thought about this painting and connected it in some manner with his love of the Mexican Day of the Dead. I moved on until I came to Wheatfield with Crows. I stared for a long time at its desperate urgency, the bold and wild strokes, the menacing black and blue sky, the jagged descending crows, the paths running off the ends and the center path disappearing into the wheat field. It gave me a sense of no escape, madness and dark foreboding everywhere, disastrous omens. "I'd probably kill myself after painting this too," I thought. I hadn't quite reached that stage yet, but Vincent had made his point. I went outside to have a smoke, collect my thoughts, and wait for Kaori. Unconsciously, I put my hand in my pocket and started rubbing the box again. A strong desire to take the mushrooms came over me. It was as if both Pablo and the spirit of Van Gogh were egging me on. For madmen only, the price is only your mind. Reclaim your soul. Kaori emerged 20 minutes later. She sat down on the curb next to me. Neither of us spoke a word. We proceeded to Vondel Park. We stopped near a pond to listen to some reggae singers, then walked on the footpath to the round blue tea house, drank a beer, and listened to the sounds of birds before retracing our steps out of the park and back to the Lidsiplein, where a large crowd had gathered to listen to a Mongolian street band with string instruments and voices that sounded like reed instruments. On a side street, we stopped for raviolis at an Italian restaurant run by a Turkish family. High wisps of white clouds scudded across the sky. Late afternoon shadows covered the narrow street. We shivered. Kaori said, "It feels like autumn, like just before winter in Japan." Back at the hotel, we took a bath. I rolled a joint to smoke while Kaori outlined on a map the places and roads we'd followed and seen since arriving. Every 15 minutes the Eau de Kirk bell rang. I think we were both content at that moment, each in a separate world of thoughts and memories. At 7:30 I went alone to the Siberia, while Kaori studied about the history of the relationship between Japan and Holland. The Siberia was crowded again. After 2 cups of tea and another joint, I returned to the hotel. I propped myself on the bed and Kaori began massaging my feet. "I've been reading about some interesting things today," she said. "Like what?" "Mainly about the history of the relationship between Japan and Holland. I brought a book called Oranda Kiko by Shiba Ryotaro, one of my favorite writers. His way of writing is so human, and he has a real grasp of ordinary people acting with spirit and courage to meet the demands of their times. He has great respect for the Dutch people and their independent spirit, especially for how they could reclaim this land from the sea and make it theirs, make a country from nothing." "Yes, I remember watching some documentaries about Mongolia by him on TV with you. He had a great love for those people too, it seems." "He was a humanist, and a man with a great passion for art. I could appreciate what we saw today at the Van Gogh Museum because of reading what he wrote about Van Gogh's life. I could feel what was in Van Gogh's soul while looking at those paintings. You know, I actually cried when looking at the paintings from his Arles period. I've never cried from just looking at a painting before. It was a new and beautiful experience." Kaori stopped massaging my foot, flashed me a smile, and started again. "I know what you mean. I remember a lot of the feelings I had back in 1973 on my first journey to Europe, and the profound influence that art and history had on me. Everything was so new and powerful and passionate, and it gave me the impetus to want to create something myself." "That's not exactly the feeling I meant about me. It was more a private feeling. I could feel the same sadness. I felt the same sadness. And I understand how depressed and low a human being can be. You remember how I was after my operation." Kaori stopped again for a moment and looked at me with sad eyes. "Yes, I do. That was very low. Now I feel how important life is, how important every moment is, and how wonderful it is to be alive and feeling nature all around us." Kaori gestured toward the window and the sky outside. "I have really loved looking at the sky in Holland, and the Dutch painters really know how to paint the sky." "I think I know what you mean. I like the landscapes and the different shades of blue and white and gray that are used. I don't know exactly, but there's a sense of great movement across the sky, like the wind blowing off the sea." "Yes, that too. But what I've really noticed is how high the sky is. The sky seems higher here than in Japan. I always look at the sky every day when I hike at Tempai Mountain, and it's different here, different from any place I've seen. Maybe it's because we're at sea level here. And the clouds are not summer clouds, they're autumn clouds." "Even the shadows and light are autumn shadows and light. I've noticed that too." Very unusual, but I love it. Kaori shifted her weight on the bed and began massaging my other foot. I really like Amsterdam. I'm so happy you brought me here.
I'm glad you're happy. I leaned over and stroked Kaori's hair. It does feel good to be here again for me, too.
The interesting thing for me is that I'm enjoying learning, and I really feel, more than I've ever felt using English in any of my jobs, that all the years of studying English have been worth it. Without English, I couldn't do all the things that I'm doing.
Such as?
Such as trying to understand the transportation system, where you can go, what it costs, what kind of discounts you can get. If you can't use the transportation system, you're not free, or at least you're limited in what you can see. We have only a short time, and I want to make the most of it. I want to see as much as I can, just blend into the crowd, appreciate the history and culture of this place, or any place, and enjoy being a small part of it. There. Kaori shook her hands. My hands are tired. Is that okay? Do your feet feel better?
Yeah, much better, thanks. You're a dear. I don't know what I'd do without you.
Kaori laughed and returned to her books. I was proud of the way she was approaching this trip, proud of the incredible amount of study she'd done over the years to be able to communicate and work in a second language. What she had said about the Dutch sky was true, too. I liked looking at the colors of the sky and the scudding clouds that constantly changed shape and size and color. The afternoon shadows were indeed unusual in their depth and length. It seemed to me that Kaori's observations symbolize our own lives. Our decline had begun. We were now past the peak of our days. Autumn shadows in August. The cancer and hepatitis had already consumed a portion of our flesh. Drowsiness came over me. My last thoughts before drifting off were, "What exactly have I accomplished with my life? What exactly has it been worth?" Chapter 4. I was lying on the bed. Kaori had left earlier to do some sightseeing in Edam and Volendam. Early morning sunlight poured into the room, periodically hiding behind moving clouds. I rolled a joint, took three puffs, and once again fingered the box of mushrooms. I got up stiffly, limped over to the small refrigerator, took out one of the cartons of blueberry yogurt, and returned to the bed. I grinned mischievously as I opened the box of mushrooms, dumped the four dried spores into the yogurt, stirred them around with a spoon, and uttered, "Here's to you, Mother Earth," as I lifted a spoonful with two mushrooms into my mouth. The yogurt helped suppress the bitter mushroom taste for a moment, but the familiar acrid rush at the back sides of my mouth appeared as I began chewing. I took another spoonful of just yogurt and washed the mushrooms down. I repeated the process for the remaining two mushrooms, gagged for a moment, but forced them down. Two more spoonfuls of yogurt took away the remaining bitterness. All I had to do now was wait. I picked up my notebook and began writing some sentences, but grew bored after a few minutes and set it down on the bed. For a while I watched the branches on the large tree in front of the Eau de Kerk sway in the light breeze and listened to the sounds of the streets below. I got up once to pee, returned to the bed, took a few more hits off the joint, and let random thoughts float around in my head. In the few days we'd been in Amsterdam, I had not really taken much notice of the two paintings on the walls of our room. I moved over to one of the chairs on the other side of the room so I could look at both the painting behind the bed and the one on the adjoining wall. The one behind the bed was an abstract work by Kandinsky. It had various geometrical shapes with "Jean Rouge Bleu, 1925" written at the bottom. The other was a 1905 Picasso print of a skinny clown holding his baby and watching his nude wife doll herself up in front of a hand mirror. As I was concentrating on the Picasso print, numbness crept over my body. The Siberian tiger high had crossed over to the beginning of the mushroom high. I stared at the checkered black and white outfit the clown was wearing. The lines and colors were sharp and vivid.
They seemed more real to me than anything I'd ever seen. My gaze shifted slightly lower to the basin on the table at the bottom of the print. There was a green tint to it that hadn't been there before, as well as a peculiar transparency.
"That's me in the painting. That's my life summed up in a few strokes," I thought, then grinned. I felt a sudden, poignant connection with the clown in the painting, with the symbolism it contained for my own life. My gaze swept around the room, and every object within it was transformed. There was an intensification and deepening of color, texture, and substance in everything surrounding me, even my own body. I felt a connection with everything. The room breathed quietly and shimmered in the rays of sunlight entering through the window. Everything glowed and pulsed. A breeze wafted through the open window, and with it a cacophony of sounds from outside, each sound hanging in the air and ringing loudly in my ears. A shiver passed through me, and goosebumps rose luminously from my skin. I looked down at my right hand, and it was a huge, living organism, separate from myself, yet containing the entirety of myself. Each tiny hair, too, had its own separate, meaningful existence. The pattern of my skin pores was a fascinating web of intricacy, much like the Persian carpets I'd seen years ago on that fateful journey around the world. The swollen, arthritic joints of my index finger loomed above the rest of the hand like large volcanoes in the middle of an island. The island hand glowed with an orange light, but the volcano joints were deeper, almost crimson. My blue and red veins flowed down the length of the arm like so many interconnected rivers, each carrying my virus-infected blood throughout the body. A particular luminosity formed along the long scar on my forearm. I stared at it for a long time. I took a big breath and stretched back as far as I could. I could feel the tightness in each vertebra on the spinal cord. I leaned back in the chair, exhaled slowly, then rolled my neck slowly, each crack of the neck reverberating and sending colorful explosions throughout my head. I felt the need to get up and move around, but the lower half of my body was heavy, as if sunken into thick mud. I looked down at my legs and stared at the folds and lines in my jeans. The ends of my legs disappeared into the thickness of the carpet. Again, my legs were both separate from and a part of myself. The ends turned into the carpet. Or was it that the carpet had just turned into my legs? Everything melted and molded into everything else. Where one mass ended, another began. "Wow," I said out loud. "Wow, it's great to be back in Rubberland." And I knew the familiarity of the experience. I had confidence in the experience, confidence in knowing that I, alone, like a god at the center of the universe, could will the experience into whatever I wanted it to be. After all, had I not, at the age of 24 or so, had one of the greatest basketball games of my life on acid, scoring 34 points on slow-motion jumpers from long range that flowed off the end of my fingertips with a perfect follow-through that gave the ball a perfect backspin, an extended rainbow arch, and settled perfectly into the net each time with a sweet swishing sound that had all seemingly been preordained? That had been a great night in a distant country gymnasium, with only a few spectators to watch the City League players. But I still felt its perfection deeply within, and it gave me a rush to replay in my mind and remind me of what I'd once been, and of the possibility of perfection in an imperfect world. I craved a cigarette and a beer. I had to will myself out of the chair, will myself into movement. At first I was unsteady on my feet, my body feeling like lead. And it was hilarious as I observed myself struggling like the mass of humanity. My senses floated freely in space. I felt the breeze in the room, heard the rumble of a truck changing gears and the sound of voices outside and below on the street, and saw the sunlight reflecting off every object in the room. I stared a moment at the texture of the linen on the bed, then at the grain in the wood on the bedstand, and thought, "Yes, I've crossed over to the other side now, and it's great to be back." Getting back to the original purpose,
determined ages ago, but still the original purpose, which was to move toward the portable refrigerator on the other side of the bed, I willed my leaden body into movement, and it became light and functional. The first step was easy. With the first step made, just like when dealing with the potential confusion and paranoia of conversation with real people, the challenge of it, all that's needed is to will that first sentence out of your mouth and see the other person's natural response while staring at and being fascinated by the tiniest of facial hairs moving and the blotchy variations of skin color on that other person's face. And the wave of paranoia about not being able to deal with the situation will pass, and you can even control the situation in your mad state of mind. The rest was easy. I walked over to the refrigerator, opened the door, grabbed one of the two beers I'd bought earlier, pulled the aluminum tab, luxuriated for a moment in the sound of and the rising of foam out of the hole in the top of the can, took a short drink, realizing suddenly how dry my mouth had become and how coldly and smoothly the beer slid down my throat, and trembled as an electric shiver went up and down my spine. I returned to the table and sat down again. My pack of cigarettes, an ashtray, and a lighter were on the table, so I pulled a cigarette out of the pack, picked up the lighter, lit the cigarette with trembling hands, inhaled deeply, blew the smoke into the air, and watched in fascination as the blue smoke formed rings and clouds that rose up and floated for a moment, then disappeared, just like Kaori and I and the rest of the world would in due time. The sun went behind some clouds again. Gray pervaded the room, and the air moved like waves. I breathed in the scents wafting through the window. The tree by the Eau de Kirk was shaking, and as I looked down upon the alleyway leading to the church, I noticed the pink brick building behind the soot-stained building on the corner was jutting forward, sinking deeper into the street with each breath I took. Sunlight cut through the clouds once more, and those distinct autumn shadows stretched beyond the end of the alleyway and crawled up to the looming bell tower, from which the sound of the bell began to ring, each note floating on the air, growing slowly, louder, and instead of just my ears hearing, all my senses encompass the individual clanging notes, filling my body and mind in such a way that instead of hearing the music, I was the music. I closed my eyes. Dancing arabesques appeared in the darkness. The arabesques changed colors and became varied and fantastic objects that waved about as if underwater. When the last note finally played itself out and drifted away with a strange gentleness, I opened my eyes. I felt as if a hole had opened in my head. I breathed deeply, then picked up the beer can, reassured by its weight and the knowledge there was still plenty of beer left in it and I would not have to get up again for a while, raised it slowly to my mouth, and took a sip. My cigarette had gone out, so I lit another one and turned my attention to the inner world, that world that to me was as vast and real as the external physical world, and ever so much more interesting. There I was, the vibrant force that filled the room, was the room, and all was natural that I should be there at that particular place and moment. Everything I'd ever done, thought, experienced, every path I'd traveled upon had led me there. I was glad Kaori always talked about how we'd been fated to meet and that our paths had been destined from the beginning to come together. I believed that entirely. And yes, exactly how many paths had I trod in the 49 years of my life? How many lives had I touched, had touched me? How many significant moments had changed the course of those many paths? It was time for a mushroom re-examination of everything.